Welcome to Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm your host, Mary Kay Magstud. Seeing into the future doesn't require a crystal ball or tarot cards, though in my neighborhood in San Francisco, there are quite a few fortune teller shingles hung. Don't know why. There's also something else here in the Bay Area. Groups that look at what's happening now as a way of thinking about what might happen next. One of them is the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, which was founded almost half a century ago by the Rand Corporation. It has a pretty good track record of calling it right, of seeing important trends early. It's on a corner in a neighborhood of boutique shops and sidewalk cafes. Glance into its display window and you might do a double take. You'll see what the Institute likes to call artifacts from the future, a playful take on what people might be using or wearing in a particular version of the future. When I visited, the artifacts on display were a little startling.
This fashion show from in the time of apocalypse, so there are a lot of masks of various kinds. Obviously, the air is not very good.
So you've got these goggles.
We've got goggles, a lot of goggles, and a lot of filters.
Right, I could have used one of those when I was living in Beijing.
Yeah, I know.
That's Marina Gorbis, the executive director of the Institute for the Future. She took me to a display of perfumes from this apocalyptic future. These are scents that could disappear as a result of climate change.
I don't know, with this one. This one is honey, which obviously is about honeybee collapse. This one.
One says wine.
Yeah, well, wine because of droughts. Peanuts, I guess, are also a crop. Oh my gosh, it does smell like peanuts. So, ice is another one.
Eucalyptus? Ice?
Yeah, well, ice is disappearing, right? We know that. What do you think? Yeah. We had these kids, like 10-year-olds, come in, and they just loved it. And it's amazing, actually, just having conversations and using this.
This gallery of the future, which is not always apocalyptic, is meant to provoke thought and spark conversation. So is the work the Institute does, sometimes for companies or organizations, sometimes just as general research. I sat down with Marina to get a practitioner's view of seeing into the future. I mean, how do you know what to look for?
The kind of futures work we do, big sort of transformational stories, given not just events in one area, but in many different areas, what's a larger world we're moving to? We oftentimes use this, what is the world we're moving from to? How are we going to work? What's family life? What's our daily routine going to be like? What's happening with technologies? What's happening with demographics, economics? All of these disparate sort of disciplines together to think about kind of larger patterns.
And do you think of it as looking for ways to forecast or make predictions, or are you looking at parallel futures? I mean, just conceptually, how do you come at it?
We always say that we don't believe that you can predict the future. You know, you can predict sort of singular events, but these kind of big transformational complex kind of stories is what we're really after. So we use a lot of different methodologies. One is scenarios approach, where we do look at potential scenarios. And what we've learned, it's not that one scenario is going to come true, but probably there are pieces of all of these scenarios that we're going to see emerge. So one of the methodologies we use is something developed by Jim Dator, who is a futurist at the University of Hawaii, called alternative futures methodologies, which basically says that there is these archetypal future stories that you can think about. One is growth scenario, which is basically, it doesn't necessarily mean growth, but it means that things will continue as they've been. We're on the same path. The other archetypal scenario is collapse. So it could be a system collapse or a subsystem collapse. Think about environmental collapse, bee colony collapse, and things like that. Another one is constrained, and it could be environmental constraint. It could be constraint. We're living in California with water constraints. It could be energy constraints, other kinds of things. And the last scenario that oftentimes is the hardest to think about is transformation. What if we're moving into a really different path? The a lot of times it's about technologies. Technologies enable us to do things in completely different ways. If we think about today and a lot of things we're seeing, you know, we're seeing elements of collapse and constraint and transformation and growth, all of this happening at the same time. But really the purpose of what we do is for people to expand their thinking and what's in their toolkit of possibilities that they think about to ultimately help them make better decisions.
What does it take to be a good futurist?
I think to be a good futurist, you have to be in a community of other people who are really great thinkers in their own right and who are great spotters of signals and who are able to think together. In addition to our staff who are here, we're about 40-some people, and we've been doing it for a long time. We have a vast community of people who are affiliates and fellows and people who just come by and they think of themselves as part of our communities. The other thing is that I do think that it's almost like art. I think of future thinking as much science as it is art, but like an artist, artist has technique and brushes and paints and all these tools. And the longer you do it, the better you get at it because you keep like probing and asking and you learn certain patterns that work. So having some longevity actually really helps. And I do think that one of the really important things in being a futurist is to abandon whatever narrow discipline you've been trained in and go beyond that discipline and being able to look at the same phenomena from very different set of eyes and connecting these. It's ultimately an art of patterning. It's like the art of saying, I see it here, this is how these people look at it, this is how this looks at it. And if you connect those two, you can create a much more robust framework.
I imagine you have very lively debates and maybe even heated debates here between people who come from different disciplines. Even as they're abandoning their discipline, they still have a perspective as they come in and look at an issue. How does that go when you get people coming in saying, no, that's not the future. This is what's important. We should be looking at this signal.
It's interesting. So in our work team, looking at the future of work, we have very, very robust discussions. Ultimately, the same discussions that everybody has about, does that mean we're not going to work, or does that mean there's going to be more jobs? And actually, you know, the good thing is that we change our minds on this. It's almost like the process of thinking about some domain starts as, I call it, blob on the horizon. Like you see something that's kind of like interesting, but you don't know what shape it's going to take. And the more you start looking at it, the more it takes shape. It's like carving a sculpture. It's sort of like, oh, the shape kind of emerges. In the process, you may start seeing things differently. So it's not that we actually have fights about this. It's more we're a very collaborative group, and we kind of assume that everybody brings something really valuable to the conversation, but we do have disagreements. And a lot of times, like on the team, we may say, okay, we're seeing this in a very, like when we talk about whatever, like I'll take work as an example, I may tell a different story than my colleague. We will come in from the same perspective, but he or she may see it slightly differently. Because we work so much in teams, we're constantly learning from each other. And so I may change how I see my thing.
What brought you to the Institute for the Future?
So when I graduated, I went to policy school at Berkeley, and sort of my interest was economic development. And so I went to SRI, Stanford Research Institute, and I did that work. And then I just heard about the Institute. I never considered myself a futurist. I kind of considered myself an economist and development economist. But I met Bodger Hansen, who is president of the Institute, and he said, oh, you've been doing stuff globally. We're interested in bringing people like that. But like everybody at the Institute, we were not trained as futurists. We were trained in some discipline, and probably one of the necessities of being futurist is ability to transcend your discipline. Like when we look at the domain like work, we want to bring very different perspectives on how we look at it. So we have anthropologists doing ethnographic research on people who are working in on-demand economy to understand those patterns here and now. We have economists who are looking at the economics of labor and how it works. We have technologists who are looking at what's the next generation of technologies. And then we bring them all into the room and we ask the question, what do you see? Where is this going? We want these conversations and these signals that we're seeing with very different lenses to come together and create a larger story.
And how often, I mean, you personally have been doing this for how long?
I've been at the Institute for about 18 years now.
18 years. So over that time, as you've been bringing together these larger stories, and then you look back, what's your batting average? How are you doing in terms of being able to say, yeah, you know, we pretty much got that right. Or, you know, at least we were in the ballpark there.
I was, you know, when I first came to the Institute, the first 6 months, everybody who gets here, you just have to get immersed in the language and concepts and ideas. So I was looking back through a lot of Institute's work before then, so it's almost 20 years ago. And I was just really blown away by what I was seeing in terms of looking at what's happening with work, what's happening with the organizations, what's happening with technologies. My personal experience, so one example, just 12 years ago, we started looking at geolocation technologies, which is basically technologies that allow you to understand positioning of different things, and created kind of the first prototype, and based on that created these artifacts from the future about what are we going to be doing with these kinds of technologies when you can sense location of things and creating these things. Well, 5 years later, a lot of the things that to us were artifacts from the future became apps on iPhone, which to us was just pretty amazing. Actually, when Amazon announced their drone delivery and that they were thinking about it, somebody just brought out our artifact from the future, which actually had Amazon drone in it from like 5 years before. So, you know, we don't try to do it, but what I think we find is that when you have all these different perspectives in the room, you can create pretty robust future stories.
As the rate of the evolution of technology has sort of sped up, is it more challenging to be able to sort of keep up with what's coming up over the horizon?
You know, what we found is actually in terms of technologies are fairly easy to forecast, like the basic technologies to roadmap, because you know where the money is going. You know what people are developing in labs. You know kind of what some of the scientific breakthroughs and what people are working on. So that's fairly easy to forecast. What's much more difficult to forecast is once these technologies get into the wild, they get into people's hands, they enter our lives, what are people going to be doing with them? Because humans find all kinds of, as people say, street uses of technology that engineers and technologists and scientists just can't forecast. In fact, I think engineers and technologists are usually the worst people to forecast how these technologies are going to be used because they think very rationally. Marshall McLuhan had this famous saying that we invent our technologies and thereafter our technologies reinvent us. And it's sort of we're in this constant co-evolution of technologies change, and then we change them, and we adapt them to different uses, and then we invent things. We create new needs, new challenges, and so we invent technologies for those needs and challenges. And it's like this constant process of co-evolution.
Does something come to mind about like a technology where those who invented it assumed it would be used in a particular way, and then people actually adopted it and used it very differently?
When I first started working at the Institute, the big conversation was around connected home and networked home. So all your devices, your video, your music, your appliances, everything will be connected, and you have this magic sort of smart home where everything talks to each other. We were actually doing ethnographic interviews in the homes at the time and basically came out with the conclusion that It will never work like that, because basically if you want that kind of system, you need a systems admin. People were bringing basically their understanding of how offices work. And in the office, you have a systems admin, or you have an IT department that makes sure that all these things talk to each other. You don't have that function in the home. So we basically said that's not how people live. They need to connect on an ad hoc basis when they need to, and they don't want everything connected because that means that they have kind of very little privacy and all these other things that you find out from just talking to people. You realize it's not going to work like that. It's going to be much more messy. It's going to be much more ad hoc. And so, you know, when we were working with companies around this concept, that's what we brought to them, to say, don't try to develop something that universally connects everything. Give people opportunities to connect on an ad hoc basis when they need to and how they want to at that particular time.
So has the buzz around the Internet of Things kind of shifted then? Where, you know, there certainly are concerns that, you know, well, if I completely automate my home and connect it to the Internet, someone can hack in and make my home very uncomfortable, or, you know, there can be surveillance and people can know too much about what room I'm spending time in and what I'm doing in it.
Yeah. Well, I think the buzz, and obviously everybody's talking about the Internet of Things still, but I think people are talking about it in a different way. Not many people are talking about the smart fridge that will order things for you and send those orders to the store and all that, you know, but, you know, you've got Nest and you've got kind of smart utilities that are operating and they're all connecting to your phone.
The thing with that sort of connectivity and also with your phone remembering your preferences, and you know, it sort of treats the individual person like they have no real agency, no ability to change, no ability to have new preferences or new ideas about what they'd like their life to be like. Because there are a lot of apps now and a lot of technologies that do say, okay, well, we know that you like this, so we're going to put this in front of your face. And, you know, we know that you've ordered this in the past, so here are a bunch more of these to look at.
Yeah. I think that we're still kind of in the early stages of that. So the whole area of predictive analytics, where based on, like, even today, Amazon is pretty good about giving recommendations, sort of. But if you look at these ads that follow you everywhere, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, okay, I was looking for shoes. I got those shoes. And forever now, you're giving me ads for shoes. I've totally moved on and I'm not interested in that. So what you need to be able to do to get more sort of sophisticated kind of predictive analytics is actually connect a lot of different data and a lot of different databases. So it's not just about your preferences for shoes, but maybe where are you going on vacation and what plans you're making for your vacation and what's in your calendar in terms of what's forthcoming. And that is much harder to achieve, right? To get into that, the matrix sort of scenarios where you're walking through the store and ads talk to you and really read your state. But, you know, there are pieces of these technologies that are being developed, and I think we're going to get better at it.
Yeah. So the Institute for the Future looks 10 years into the future. Why just 10 years?
That's a horizon we like to stay in. We also love to do 20 and 30 and probably more out. But there is no data about the future. So one of the methodologies we use is to look at signals. William Gibson, the science fiction writer, has this famous phrase, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And so there are signals of the future around us today. And that's a lot of the work that we do. We do ethnographic work. We look at what are people doing with these technologies. A lot of our work is looking at things that are kind of look on them like they're on the margin or they're weird, but to us they're a signal of something bigger. And 10 years out is about the right horizon because you can start seeing signals of something that will be bigger 10 years from now. What we learned is that when you're doing any kind of strategy work or you're thinking about or imagining or visioning work, although you need to maybe plan for 2-3 years out, having that more 10-year perspective helps because it gets clear where we're going. 2-3 years, you're still kind of pretty here and now.
So what do you think of the possibility of thinking about a century, like the 21st century, and thinking about what might happen within it?
I think it's great. In fact, in one of our 10-year forecasts, probably about 5 years ago, we did do that look 100 years, 50 years, and 10 years, and try to do that. I think it allows for a lot of creativity to kind of imagine the unimaginable.
When you were growing up in the Ukraine, what did the century look like to you? What did the future look like to you?
What did it look like? Oh, gosh. That's a good question. I think to me the century looked really hopeful in many ways because, you know, I grew up, my family survived World War II, or some of my family survived World War II. I would say that was a continuous presence in just daily lives because so many people were affected by it. And the fear of repeat of the war was very much kind of on everybody's mind. But it was also kind of Soviet Union experienced a lot of kind of post-war prosperity, relative prosperity. So life looked pretty good.
And did it feel to you like the Soviet Union would just keep going and be a global leader? And, I mean, how did it feel being within?
You know, I'd be the first person to say that the fall of the Soviet Union was a huge surprise. There was actually a Russian dissident who predicted it and wrote the book, I think 1989. I was fairly content as a kid, you know. We didn't have a lot, but it sort of was okay. I did music and ballet like all the kids, and life looked
like me
really
too.
Normal.
Yeah. So you left for college?
You know, I have to say that before I left, so I was 18 when I left, and life was beginning to feel like there was no more excitement. Like, it's, you know, in Russia, it's fairly, especially, you know, I'm Jewish, so there were a lot of limitations on what you could do as a Jew and where you could go to school and all of those things. But the pathways were very, very limited. So, you know, you go to a technical college, you become an engineer, which probably is what I would have become. Everybody in Russia becomes an engineer of some kind. Even if you're an economist, you were called an economics engineer. And it's kind of like life was very predictable. You couldn't travel freely. You know, there were all these kind of, life felt closed at that point. And I would say that was my experience by the time I was 18 and one of the reasons I left. And sure enough, you know, here when you're 18, life is just opening up, right? You know, you have choices about where to go to college or not to go to college and where to live and all of these things. Not everybody has those choices, but a lot of people do, and certainly a lot more than in Russia. So it felt constricted. That's what it felt like. It didn't feel like that when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, it's just you're a kid and you're doing all these great things. But it did feel very, very constricted at that point. And when I came here, it was just such open opportunities, which is, for many people, is very, very hard. And I look at my son's experience where he's constantly struggling with choices, and that puts a different kind of pressure on you, and it creates a lot more stress. Life was kind of not that stressful because the choices are made for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard more than one non-American friend who comes here and looks at a supermarket and is like, why do you need 50 choices of breakfast cereal or, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's too much. It takes too long to have to work through all of this.
Yeah, when my mother came here in the late 80s, I had to, like, prepare her to go to a supermarket so she wouldn't be totally overwhelmed. And she really trying to contain herself, but I could see her eyes were just popping out, and it was a pretty overwhelming experience. You know, of course, in Russia now, same things. You can go to a supermarket, and there is the same variety or almost the same.
Within the United States, there are people who are anxious that America's best times are over. There have always been people in America who have felt that way. You know, you can go to each century and mm-hmm. someone saying, oh, you know, that's it. At the moment in the United States, what do you think is important? What signals do you think are important for Americans to be paying attention to? What would create or maintain resilience, and to the extent that people care about the role that America as an entity plays in the world, to have America continue to play a constructive one?
Basically, to me, it's transformation between the world in which everything was done through formal institutions of some kind, whether it's your corporation or it's your college or university, where all the education was contained in that and in those periods of time. It's about central governments, where all the decisions are being made at that level. I think we're moving from that world where everything was done through formal institutions into the world where a lot more things are done in this emergent kind of networked way. I think increasingly people are working on what does the governance system look like in that world. If you think about how we vote today, it's fairly ridiculous that we have to go to someplace and register when you can do it online, and you can have much more robust conversations about what we're voting for in different ways. It's the same I can say about colleges and universities. And I'm not saying that face-to-face learning is not important, but the idea that, you know, you get a degree that's after 4 years and that you have to be in one place and all of your learning happens there, it's just no longer true. You know, we thought that these online courses are going to replace education, but there are a lot more ways that people can learn. And the good thing is that every moment can be a learning moment. You've got things like Wikipedia and all Khan Academy and all these things that you could be learning continuously. It's just an amazing opportunity. So all of these institutions really need to be changing. And it's beginning to happen, but we're kind of in the world right now of this new thing is popping up, new ways of doing things on the one hand, and they're very, very exciting. And on the other hand, we have established institutions and ways of doing things and sort of ways of thinking and regulating that are not really compatible with this new world.
There have always been new technologies. There have always been revolutions in the way that people do things, the way that they organize together. I mean, how do you think this era compares if you look back on the past century?
Yeah. It's very hard, you know, to look back and really say, okay, is this faster or is this about the same? Because I bet for people who for the first time had access to electricity, it must have been completely revolutionary, right? Or you're finding somebody wrote this great book about the telegraph and how even the language we used in terms of describing telegraph, the first telegraph, was the same language that we use now to describe the internet and kind of totally transformational impact and all of that. Like if I look at my own life, almost 60 years, right now feels different. Right now feels like a lot of things are changing at the same time. It's a combination of all these technologies that having these kind of combinatorial impacts. So it's not just in the internet. It's the internet plus nanotech and what we're finding about biology and computation and data analytics and sensors and all of these things coming together. It's almost like the technology infrastructure that we've been creating, we've been doing it for the last probably 50 years. You know, Uber didn't just appear out of nowhere. Uber is based on a whole kind of continuing evolution of technologies, which is the internet. You know, packet switching is the first layer. Then we added sensor technologies to that. We added geolocation technologies. Now it's data analytics and all these cumulative things. And so it's like for the last 40, 50 years, we've been building this technology, and now this technology is really changing our organizational, social, and economic landscape. You know, one of the former presidents of the Institute, Ian Morrison, wrote this book, The Second Curve, in which he argued that in any period of large transformation, which I believe we're in now, And I think we're kind of early in this transformation. We're kind of living along two curves at the same time. One is sort of incumbent curve. We've established, we've lived like that for a long time. We have regulations, we have practices, we know how to live on this curve. But that way of doing things is kind of on the decline. And at the same time, we have this nascent or emergent curve, new way of doing things. You see signals of it. There are new things popping up, not completely clear which way it's going to go, but it's kind of the struggle between these two curves. And I think that's exactly where we're finding ourselves right now.
And do you find that this new curve is having an energizing effect, or that people are reacting to it more with anxiety, or both at the same time?
Both. I think that it's energizing a lot of new things and capabilities, new affordances that we're creating, but at the same time, it's scary. And we probably will see resistance to that. You know, the fact is that you can't put technologies and these things that we have today back into the box. So we can't just go back to nostalgia and say, we just want things to be the way they've always been. But I would say that the future doesn't just happen to us. We have agency in terms of what future we want to shape. That's why paying attention to the platforms and how we structure them and what elements we put into them, we have some agency in shaping this second curve, this nascent curve, and how it evolves. And this is our moment to start thinking about that.
Marina Garbus, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
That was Marina Garbus, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California. I'll be coming back to her for a future podcast on the future of work, which is a subject the Institute has been focused on for a while. Meanwhile, you can find more on this topic and others on our website, pri.org/century, where we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or download it from SoundCloud or Stitcher. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstead, and PRI's The World, in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Come on back and listen in.